tonight to mark the death yesterday of the great Irish writer Edna O'Brien, Irina brings us back to two wide-ranging interviews she did on the show with Sean Rooks. In a little while, we'll go to the lengthy conversation Sean had in studio with Edna O'Brien in August of 2022, in advance of the Abbey's production of her play Joyce's Women. This was, in fact, the great novelist's final interview on RTE Radio. But before that, let's hear Edna O'Brien speaking with Sean on Arena to mark the occasion of her 90th birthday in December of 2020.
Tomorrow marks a very special occasion for my next guest and for the whole of the country, in fact, one of our most cherished and lauded writers, who has already a six-decade career of astonishing work behind her, will celebrate her 90th birthday. Last year, on receiving the David Cohen Prize for Literature, she was praised for having, quote, moved mountains, both politically and lyrically, and that was through her writing. It's a great honour and joy to have Edna O'Brien with us this evening. Happy birthday ahead of tomorrow, Edna. What are the plans in terms of celebration? Are there many?
Answering the door. Well, there aren't many, really, because, you know, with this virus that everyone is nervous of, social life is very limited. And I just feel being 90 at all is a bit of a miracle. It's also, I don't probably have as much energy as I had at 80. But I have no big plans, no. I couldn't, really. Not this year. I'm not really helping you because I'm truly not doing anything. Because it's not the year to do something.
Does that mean that you are or are not writing, then, in this year?
Well, I mean, who'd be writing if I'm getting all these messages and phone calls and interviews? I've written the T.S. Eliot lecture. I finished it last week, and it goes out tomorrow evening. That took 11 months, so that was writing.
And did that take a different type of energy or a different type of toll on you?
Yes, very different. Very different part of the mind, body, imagination, investigation, nervousness. Very, very different indeed, because it involves huge, perhaps too much, because I'm rather... what's the word? I'm still a convent girl in that way. A lot of research and therefore making notes and losing them. Not that writing is a free activity, but writing something that comes just from the imagination is more freeing than writing something about someone else, when you have to be very certain of all your facts and try and make it then seem like a work of imagination. Make it seem creative or spontaneous or whatever the words are. So that is a harder task. They're all hard, actually. Mm-hmm. If I'd finished a novel yesterday, I'd be probably saying the same thing.
When that award that you won last year, the David Cohen Prize, the citation said, as I mentioned in my introduction, that you moved mountains both politically and lyrically. What type of mountains do you think you've been moving over the years? Did you feel that it was an apt description of what you've been doing with your writing?
Well, I felt it was very complimentary. I think it would be for others to say whether it was apt or not. I was very pleased I was very pleased to get it. But I was also very pleased about the fact that my books are political. They don't seem so. But what I do, or aim to do, is to take a political situation and make it the backdrop to a human story. So a direct political book, like, say, Fritz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, that's a purely political book, and it's a very good book and a very disturbing book. I'm still very interested, for some reason, in human beings and how... and what people do to each other or don't do, in how people behave in difficult situations, in crisis, and so on. And in with both girls, which was about the Boko Haram capturing and young schoolgirls and submitting them to every known kind of humiliation and trauma. And so taking the human story and giving it its also its political dimension. But the political part is there. It is like the mountain. And the human story is sort of all along. I saw today that Etna erupted. I thought, yeah, that's what writing is. It's an eruption of a kind which has to be, if it's going to be any good or last any length of time, has to have some beauty, the way music has beauty, has to have some, not some, but a lot of that, and of truth, and of human palpability. That the reader will feel, I want this as a writer, and I want it as a reader, that the reader will feel when reading the story, this is a story of real people.
So is the initial impetus then, for example, in the case of Girl, and it's a fictional story of a young character called Miriam, a Nigerian girl who's captured by Boko Haram. Is the initial impetus the political situation that you were reading about in the newspaper, seeing in the news, and that you then say, I have to find a fictional way to tell this story or to make comment on this? Or was the initial impetus some fictional idea, this character who was somehow spurning you on?
Well, to tell you the truth with that, Sean, it's very hard to know which comes the car before the horse or the horse before the cart. They're intertwined. One wouldn't, there's a lot of political stories in the world, God help us. They're everywhere. Camps, refugees, migration, wars, they're everywhere. The Middle East is like a bloodbath. I picked that particular one because I felt or hoped that I could identify with the inner life of a girl in that awful situation. I could identify with her fear, not to the same extent as she felt it, but it wasn't alien terror. It was alien to me, and yet I felt I knew some of it. As I said, there are other stories I could have taken on board, but with Girl and with The Little Red Chairs, I took on political stories, and I felt that even before I started, you have to know before you start that I was, that I'd make it, that I could do it. With effort, with time, with faith, hope, and all those other qualities. Whereas some stories, I could not even attempt to begin. And I did read a lot. I read a lot of journalists, including Sally Hayden from Ireland. She reports for the Irish Times. And I met with her, and she was wonderful. So the research was enormous. I went twice to Nigeria, I went to camps, I went to schools, I went to organizations, I went to parents, I went to, you name it. And some of it was very, very heartbreaking, and is very heartbreaking. Even yesterday, or maybe it was the night before, there was another case in Nigeria from another school. 400 people were taken.
Yes.
And it didn't say who was responsible. Well, it probably will by this evening. So there's no division. There's division, but it's fine to ask the question. But I cannot answer it in a sort of, if you like, a logical way. I had a hunch I could do this, and my hunch was borne out by my going there.
There was some criticism. Obviously, people have heard about the New Yorker magazine, and particularly this idea that somehow it was the horror of that story that attracted you rather than something
yes,
else.
And I was very annoyed by that. I was deeply annoyed by that. If I wanted to write a horror story, I'd write a horror story. I wanted to write a human story. It was a very wrong, not only wrong, it was an unwise way to think of the book, and it was rash. You know, I mean, there are horror stories, plenty of them in the world. They don't suit me either as a reader or a writer. Girl is a human story. I read Greek myths. I read the stories of Hecuba, Electra, all those men and women in crisis, and the things that happen to people in crisis, and how they bear it. How do they bear it? That is the question.
Was the reaction to Girl in some way similar to the reaction to In the Forest back in 2002, when similarly there were this idea that perhaps you were taking a very personal story, the murder of Imelda Riney and her young son, that you were taking that very closely intimate story and making fiction out of it? Was it a similar type of reaction to the reaction to Girl, do you think?
There's a resemblance, definitely. It's usually to do those who begrudge or cavil or say I shouldn't do it or you shouldn't do it or it shouldn't be done. They usually have an agenda which is not stated. The world is full of stories. The world needs stories. I have written stories about domestic life, domestic situations, love, mothers, everything, funerals even, old wounds, who'll pay for the tombstone, etc. But not to say that somebody has no right, that one is no territorial right on another, on a country that isn't one's own or a story that isn't one's own, is a form of censorship in itself that I do not go with. There should be no borders to the imagination. The only border that I would call for would be that the book is written, if you like, from within. It has the inner pulse. It has that the writer has come to know, both through research, through intuition, and God knows what else, through luck, what the internals of that story should be. And the people who object are usually doing so for quite personal and, I regret to say, sometimes ignoble reasons.
What about the type of energy, the type of mountain that you have to move? You're speaking about, I suppose, the political side of the story in many of those comments, but the energy that you have to use, the mountain that you have to move within yourself to get to that inner life, to get to the internals of a book.
Oh, it's a nightmare. That's what I'd like to say to some of my... But mind you, with Girl, I was very lucky with Girl in many places. I have the paperback here with radiant quotes on it. In the Forest was more personal, was made more personal. The objection to Girl in the United States, apart from that one profile you mentioned, which is best forgotten, but the so-called good reviews said they were waiting. One critic said she was waiting for the real book about Boko Haram, a girl. There's no one real book. We know the facts of the story. Each girl will be affected by her incarceration differently, will dream differently when she's there, and if she's lucky enough to get out, will dream differently. Will remember certain moments that another girl will have forgotten, and vice versa. So there's many stories. It's not like a single piece of journalism.
In the case of the Country Girls, it was 3 weeks. You sat down at the desk, and I think it was a matter of weeks later you had it all written. And
it came. Oh, that was such a lovely feeling. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. 3 weeks it gets me to write the first paragraph. 3 more weeks to write the second one. That is inevitable. I think a first book is like a winged messenger. It comes to one, which is sometimes not always, but sometimes a little disquieting for an author, because she or he then begins to do the next book and finds that it's not as easy. First book is waiting. The second book, third book, 10th book, 15th book, they have to be dredged out. It doesn't mean they're better or worse. It just means that it's like drawing water from a well. How much more is left in the well?
Well, Girl was your 19th novel. Is there a 20th novel down at the bottom of that well, even if you have to get the bucket down very deep to find it?
Oh, I'm afraid so. There's no other way. There's no other way. And it's not simply by will alone, although it needs very strong will to do it. It's by that mysterious thing called inspiration, which does come, oddly enough. And also in the doing, when you start a book and you're floundering a bit or you're unsteady about your material, by keeping with it and by reading certain significant things, not quite the same story, but have something of the same quality, you find yourself becoming richer. For instance, there's a great book I have always loved by Joseph Conrad called The Heart of Darkness. I read and reread The Heart of Darkness many times when I was writing Girl. Mine is a totally different story. Joseph Conrad's was Congo, in fact, and it was on a boat. It was by the main character was male, but there was something very hard again to verbalize or to explain clearly about the landscape itself, the enormity of it, the loneliness of it, then the sort of mystery within it. There's a darkness in it, and you come on people where you never think you would come upon them. And in many ways, it gave me not facts, but it gave me a sense of a landscape. Because landscape, as when I wrote all my early books and short stories, the Irish landscape, County Clare, was of great, well, it enriched the stories, and it was of great, I thought about it a lot, and it was like a character itself. It moved me. It still moves me.
Coming
it's
then...
It's so hard to kind of say precisely what it is that makes one a writer. That's often what families, people within the same families, often wonder why that person could write a book and he or she in that same family couldn't. I mean, it is a gift, for want of a word. Well, no, that's the word. It is a gift that then has to be worked at studiously and constantly. And that comes from rereading, well, reading, but in the case of great books, rereading and rereading and learning.
Coming then to the T.S. Eliot lecture, which will be broadcast in the Abbey Theatre tomorrow night, what was his gift? And what did you discover in putting that lecture together was his gift?
Well, I'll tell you, the person who would solve that, T.S. Eliot, wouldn't be able to tell you himself either. He had a gift. It's like, you know, a child born with, you know, in the time when we believed in the fairies. The way in poetry, not in critical essays and not in his plays, but in his poetry, the way he just moves, he glides from one scene. Every line is a scene in itself. And the way it moves just arbitrarily to something totally different. And the music, talking of music, that he brings to each line, the shifting of thought, the shifting of emotion, and something that you, as a reader, this sounds paradox to say, that something one both understands and does not understand. In the fact that you can read it each time, you know, I read the Wasteland and the Four Quartets and some of those poems again and again. And each time I found something extraordinary in them and something I hadn't seen the first time. And what is so seductive about T.S. Eliot, and I mean the word seductive, is the way he does it, the language he chooses, is so fresh and yet so ancient. When you're reading it, you feel, oh, this is happening now as I'm reading it. And yes, it's infused, if that's the word, with the timelessness as well. I mean, his gift was very great. And also, I would say to say very mysterious to him himself as well. Because his prose, quite frankly, does not sing. It's thoughtful, it's critical, but it doesn't have, just doesn't have that moment or that ongoing, ceaseless moments of what, for want of the word, I can't think straight today, of magic within it. It doesn't, whereas his poetry does. And it has to be remembered, it took 7 years to write a poem. The long ones. The Wasteland took 7 years. Four Quartet took 6 or 7 years. He wrote all the time, but then from what he wrote, he had to pluck the line that he knew by instinct was the line that mattered, the line that lived.
Finally, Edna, 2020, it's safe to say, has been a most peculiar year. Now, I'm guessing it's been the most peculiar year you've experienced to date. What impact do you think it might have, if any, on literature, and when might we see that?
It'll have a considerable impact on literature, which one doesn't know yet, because these things don't show themselves for a while. They don't realise themselves within a human being or imagination. I think it probably will have made some people more thoughtful and hopefully more generous with their wealth. I think for some people will go under because the hopelessness within it, if they have very little to eat, children, no money, very cramped place to live, that will be a blight forever. And then there will be a few who will write about it in the same way as Albert Camus wrote about the plague, or people wrote about the Black Death, or John Donne made sermons about the Black Death. There will be some literature from it. There'll be a lot of casualties. And let us hope there will be some degree of wisdom, and by that, less arrogant and arrant selfishness.
Edna, an absolute privilege and pleasure to speak with you this evening. Have a great day tomorrow, whatever you get up to. Enjoy the birthday. Happy 90th from all of us here, I'm sure, in on Arena, in RTE, and throughout the country. Many people will want to pass on their best wishes to you.
Can I say the same in return? Thank you all very, very much. I feel delighted that you asked me to talk to you, and I feel delighted that someone will say, oh, she's 90, she's hanging on. So I say thank you, a big thank you. And slán segalea.
At Margate, looking very charming, you are sure to meet those girls, dear girls, those lovely seaside girls. With sticks they steer and promenade the pier to give the boys a treat. In pique silks and lace, they tip you quite a playful wink. It always is the case, you seldom stop to think. You fall in love, of course, upon the spot, but not with one girl, always with the lot. those girls, those lovely seaside girls, all dimples, smiles and curls, your head it simply whirls. They look all right, complexions pink and white, they've diamond rings and dainty feet, golden hair from Regent Street, lace and grace and lots of face, those pretty little seaside girls. There's Maud and Clara, Gwendolyn and Sarah, where do they come from? Those girls, dear girls, those lovely seaside girls, in bloom are smart, they captivate the heart when cycling down the prom. At wheels and heels and hooves, you must not look, 'tis understood, but every Johnny knows it does your eyesight good. The boys observe the latest thing in socks, they learn the time by looking at the clocks. Those girls, those lovely seaside girls, all dimples, smiles and curls, your head it simply whirls. They look all right, complexions pink and white, they've diamond rings and dainty feet, golden hair from Regent Street, lace and grace and lots of face, those pretty little seaside girls. When you go to do a little boating, just for fun you take those girls, dear girls, those lovely seaside girls. They all say we so dearly love to see their way on board they make. The wind begins to blow, each girl remarks, how rough today, it's lovely, don't you know? And then they sneak away. And as the yacht keeps rolling with the tide, you'll notice hanging o'er the vessel's side. Those girls, those lovely seaside girls, all dimples, smiles and curls, each head it simply whirls. They look a sight, complexions green and white, their hats fly off and at your feet falls golden hair from Regent Street. Rouge and puffs slip down the cuffs of pretty little seaside girls.
Since 1960 and the publication of her astonishing first novel, The Country Girls, Edna O'Brien has been one of the of Ireland's leading writers. Lyrical and fearless in six decades of novels, short stories, plays, biographies and memoir. After the success of her latest novel, Girl, which explored the kidnapping of schoolgirls by Boko Haram in Nigeria, Edna returns to a writer who has been, as she says herself, her ultimate hero for 60 years, that writer being James Joyce. This time, she's writing for the stage, for the Abbey Theatre. Joyce's Women is a portrait of the artist through six of the women in his life, including Nora, his daughter Lucia, his patron Harriet Shaw Weaver, and others. I'm absolutely delighted that Edna O'Brien is with me in studio this evening. Lovely to have you here, Edna.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you very much.
And you're coming to us almost directly from rehearsals for the play, in fact.
Not almost directly, directly. Yes, I've come for the first week of rehearsal, or 8 or 9 days, and then disappear. And what is very interesting about rehearsals, and the director, Conall Morrison, is wonderful about it, because some directors only wish to work with dead authors. In fact, most directors. And also, they do not wish a how a scene might be played, because it's written in, there's many characters in this play, and also the scenes vary so much. So I've had a quite demanding time, and I've also enjoyed it very, very much, because the willingness of the actors to know everything that's behind what's written on the page, to know also the mutation of line one to line two, because the play needs that. I tried to write a play that, you know, there are all the great masters I've read and seen the works of. And Joyce himself, his playwright was Ibsen. He wrote Ibsen when he was 17 years of age, a letter which says, "It is growing dark for you now." And what Ibsen had done, of course, it eventually grew dark for Joyce. So I wanted to learn, or hope to, from all the existing plays that I've both read and seen in Europe, in Ireland sometimes, in England sometimes. And Ibsen was not my master. I don't know who my master was, but I'd like to tell you one moment that will tell you, if I may. I was very nervous writing this play, and it took me the best part of 2 years, because Joyce's life is both so, it's on so many levels, poor, a good child, then an absolute prig at university, then a lost soul, then elopement, and so on. His life is full of drama, and he created drama wherever he went. And by drama, I also mean commotion. He was also, for leaving Ireland, his attempt to borrow money is hilarious. A toothbrush from one person, toothpaste from another. And he had no money, but he knew he had to leave the Ireland of that time. And my dream, which helped me, and then you can ask me detailed things, I was writing the play and feeling, and my original secret title for it was Kill All Holy, because I felt it should be quite a daring play and that it should be fearless. I wanted that. So I'm having a dream that I'm in a boarding house of rather run-down circumstances in New York with a former publisher of mine. In the same guest house is Joyce's wife, Laura, and their son, Giorgio. And they know that I'm writing about Joyce, a play. They know it. Mm. No exchange has happened between us. And one says to the other, "Do you think she'll bring us off?" With resentment in their voices. And one says to the other, "I don't think so." I get out of bed in what is habitually called a panic. It never happened to me in my life before, and probably never will again. After a pause, I go back into bed, straight back into sleep, but more surprisingly, straight back into the dream. And in the dream now, Joyce is there, and he has overheard their original, rather grudging. And he says, for me, really, and for them, but he says it aloud, "Give her a chance. There's plenty of time yet for wine and wassail." So I waken again. And I think, oh my God, this is good. But, what does wassail mean? I confused it slightly with the word wail, wailing.
Right. Yeah.
So I get up, I have to find a dictionary. But there had been an electrician said to do all the electrics in my house, and they put the books everywhere. So my many dictionaries, it took me another 10 minutes to find one of them. Look up wassail, and it's an old Norwegian song, which the Scottish, because it's nearest Scotland, Norway, which means fun and ructions and lots of things.
Yes, I suppose Bacchanalian, but in a Norse sense. Yeah. There's a touch of that, isn't there?
And what it did for me, I have to tell you, it gave me such, admittedly, I gave myself the dream. But in my mind, ravelled as it is, Joyce gave me license in the dream to write the play the way I wanted to write a play. I didn't want a little neat play and a sort of small domestic drama. I wanted a wild domestic drama because that's what he had.
What's interesting, the fact that that dream story is quite extraordinary, and the fact that you went back to sleep and the same dream continued with Joyce.
Never happened to me before, never will again. But he stood there, I could see his face as clearly as all the photographs I've seen of him, and his glasses and his piercing eyes. And he says, "Give her a chance."
Yeah.
What
so he gave me a chance.
What an imprimatur to get from the, from
yes,
the man
it's
himself.
It's an amazing dream. And let us hope there's a bit of wood here, that there's, a good it's a good omen.
Did it, the fact that it came to you in that dream-like form, not dream-like, in an actual dream, did that then feed into the form of the way you wrote the play? Because it strikes me that there's a kind of dream-like quality.
Yes.
The kind of lack of, I suppose, narrative through line, to use that phrase.
It's a dream play with lots of phonic Finnegan's Wake. By that, with a lot of reality. It's a dream play, but not like Strindberg's Dream, for instance, his dream play, which I saw production of in Stockholm that Ingmar Bergman had done. Ibsen's play is, Strindberg's play is all dream and in a way loses its way. I mean, Strindberg is a great writer, but it loses its way because the dream takes over the credibility. So when we say, or I say, or you noticed that it is a dream play, it's a dream play with reality and dream colliding. And by that, I was able to have freedom. The freedom to bring anyone in at any moment. His jealous brother, his mother who has come back to curse him, his wife whom he saw looking in the window of a fur shop. And I was able to juggle with time, with characters, and therefore with drama. Because as I have learned from failures, drama is not fiction. Drama is drama. And one of the things is constantly, as Shakespeare had reminded us, and people who have written about Shakespeare have reminded us, drama is a series of traps. There's no point in sitting there and watching a nice little cozy or even uncozy series of events. Something dangerous happens in every scene, a danger with consequences. So Joyce himself isn't on stage as often as a person might think. But this whole universe around him are fighting for his, to be uppermost in his mind, are fighting for their place in his love, which is very important. They're fighting each other and they're fighting fate. And that gave me the license. Once I had the structure, and the structure, as I begin it, I have a balladeer singer whom Joyce knew of called Zosimus.
Yes.
And Zosimus was an 18th century, almost blind balladeer. Zosimus, if you like, introduces the play. And you think, in some ways it is, but in some ways it's not. It's going to be a roistering work. You know, Finnegan's Wake. Mm. It is a roistering work with a lot of terror and with many dimensions to it. But once I had that freedom, I honestly, apart from most days panicking as well, I knew that I could bring a scene, I could have a scene with his wife as a young girl, even though we have just seen her as a woman in her 50s, pinning up her hair. She hears his whistle. And we see the young Joyce, foolish, standing in the rain with a bit of newspaper over his head under an awning. And Zosimus sees it, because Zosimus is there all the time. So Joyce of that scene, which is short, is completely different to Joyce in the next scene, where he's arranging to borrow and to get from the...
His pals in the Martello Tower.
His gear from the Martello Tower. So it's a dream in that sense, in that it moves.
It has the logic
of
a dream.
It has a logic and the illogic of dream,
What I wondered was, within the play, however, because you mentioned this idea of lovers within it, and obviously Nora and James come to mind for sure in that, But there's a very clear jealousy of a different kind between mother and daughter here,
oh, yes.
Nora Barnacle.
More
Lucia, really, it becomes Lucia's play. How insistent was she in the dream? And when did she make her voice so loudly heard? Because it's all over the play.
You mean in my play or
yes,
in life?
In your play.
Yes. Lucia, you know, they were ragamuffins, James and Nora. They had very little money. They were travelling from Pola to Trieste because of jobs. He taught. Mm. I mean, he was a very eccentric teacher. Mainly talked about brothels and things. Not exactly what you'd... But when their children were small, they didn't mean as much to him. When they began to grow up a bit, his daughter Lucia, who in a way is the very much the pivot in the drama of this play, not in the narrative, but in the drama that causes such havoc. She was a dancer or would-be dancer, and it was claimed by newspapers that she had the gifts of Isadora Duncan, which she more or less believed. However, she did not. It was a very tough world, as it still is, the dancing world. And in their dancing world, they were mutating from ballet to modern dancing and doing different. So it wasn't something like your neat little ballerina in a pink leotard. So when she failed at that, she failed at a public competition at which her whole life was built towards. By failing, she didn't win the place. She became extremely disturbed and disheartened. But it was then that Joyce saw the enormity of what had happened to her.
Can I? There was one thing that struck me about the fact that Lucia does, for me, become the centre of the play, certainly from what I read of the script at the point, the draft that I was looking at. It struck me that here is Lucia battling in the society that Joyce was living in, obviously the early to mid 20th century. Now, yes, we are on the continent of Europe. It struck me about there the focus becomes onto this young woman. The focus was on the young women in Country Girls. The focus was on a young woman in Girl. Do you see parallels between those young women and the struggles they had in their very different societies? And was that something that interested you as a writer?
It probably is, but it never occurred to me. It's a kind of instinctive. It's true, there is a connection, but it's not a feminist work or it's not a tirade of how women have, because it's more emotional than that. In each case, in the case of Girl taken by the Boko Haram, it's brutal, it's savage. In the case of the Country Girls, it was, I suppose, my alter ego, longing like Chekhov's three sisters who longed for Moscow, longing to get out of County Clare, because I imagined a great life beyond, a life of literature. Little did I know that a life of literature is extreme, hard, unrelenting, merciless work. So it's probably in my nature or my instinct to see into the different obstacles and more than obstacles of these girls, but they're very different.
One thing that did strike me, though, particularly if we look at the fact that Lucia is a dancer, you have that theatricality. But when you're writing that, when you're writing stage directions, for example, you know, things when you talk about a frenzied dance, you leave that to be realised and lived by the actor and by the director. But when you were writing Mariam, for example, in Girl, you had to go into the...
You had to go into the pit.
Awful physicality of her pain.
Of savagery, of giving birth in a clay floor. And Girl is a very savage book, and I had a pretty savage time in Nigeria, where I went twice to what is laughingly called research. In the case of Lucia, it's more a psychological. People have asked down the years, and some have hinted, that Joyce may have had an incestuous relationship with his daughter. He did not. He loved her so much. She was his inspiratrice. Her mother could not take that. So what are we going to do? We have a girl who can no longer dance. We have a mother who's fed up of minding this girl while Joyce pens his difficult words. And naturally, we're in another crisis. Mm. So what Lucia, it was there anyhow. There was a hysteria in her as a younger person, but that keeps month by month, year by year, sliding over into something more than hysteria, madness. She was a schizophrenic. She was.
Mm. And what is the difference, I suppose, between where you bring yourself as a prose writer in the case of Girl going, and there's a section in Girl I'm thinking of as well where we get the description of the stoning of a woman. It's horrific. I can't imagine. Reading it is difficult. I can't imagine what writing it must have been like. How different is that then from writing a play where you can leave some of that, I suppose, that realisation to the actors and to the director?
Do you mean how difficult is it to write a play as opposed to prose?
Yes, I'm touching on, this idea. When you're writing the prose, you're putting it together word by word, sentence by sentence. Yeah. You're living through what happens to those women.
When you're writing a play, you're living through the scene. How will it look? Where will it begin? Maybe we'll begin in the middle of a scene. You see, you have a different freedom. And I have failed often in many ways, both in prose and drama. But I've also learned. And I've learned more. And for writing this play, I learned, I think, so much from reading a most extraordinary book by a Polish writer who is now dead called Jan Kott. And it's called Shakespeare, Our Contemporary. And it showed us, the readers, and it showed me in particular that this play, I could make it very contemporary without losing the truth of its own time and its own rules and everything. But where I think the freedom, the utter freedom came in that you have the, in your mind, if you're living it, and you have to live it, even if it's going to be acted differently or the set is different or the da-da-da is different. And, the boarding house, it's set in a boarding house in Zurich on the day Joyce died, on the day of the night Joyce died of a burst ulcer. Even that room, to imagine it, with its little black stove and the boarding house woman is a seamstress, so her sewing material is all there and her sewing machine. That gave me immense freedom. I don't know who this boarding house woman was. I never met her, but I didn't have to, because once I imagined the locale, I didn't, whereas you couldn't do that with prose.
No.
Because you have so many other props, if you like, in theatre. But you must never lose sight of the one commandment: keep the traps moving. There's no point in nice little long scenes of nostalgia or anecdote, which in the past I have been guilty of. So therefore I'm saying I learned from my mistakes to some extent. And although I said I was, which I was, in a bit of a night, whatever the word is it tizzy writing Joyce's Women, I also knew that freedom was somewhere that I could draw. And therefore, there was no difficulty for me, no difficulty from going to that room where Lucia has been violent with her mother, where there are all the women are there, to go to Joyce's deathbed, where he's half hallucinating, half remembering. The opening line he says was, and his voice has aged from the Joyce we saw, Loretta. Mm. And he says, people ask me why I never went back to Dublin, but have I ever left it?
You mentioned there this idea that, you know, did Joyce ever leave, you know, why did you leave Dublin? He never left Dublin, you could argue. Does that have resonances for you in your own life?
Joyce loved Dublin. He just didn't love what they did to him. All those little houses and the stables and the horses and Fairview and the were all in his mind. He said rather arrogantly that if the whole of Dublin was to be destroyed, it could be rebuilt from people reading Ulysses carefully.
But what about you and Clare? Can we rebuild Clare from any of your novels? You know, does Clare still hold that resonance for you that clearly, as you describe it there, Dublin held for Joyce?
It does. And I'll tell you when it holds it very much. That first thing of the weather, that breeze is different. Seeing sunshine this week is very different. It holds you forever, especially if you're a writer. Your childhood, it's like a tree when it's first planted. And the soil and the whatever fertilizing that tree is given, or whatever winds and rain and battering, forms you. And therefore, it's all in you. And at times you repress it, because you have to. You'll go mad if you keep remembering everything. And at other times, it sets you on a flow of inspiration. So it holds you back, and it also gives you freedom to soar. I make it sound very grand. It isn't. It's very difficult. But I would not be anything else, only Irish. And even though I cannot confess to having had an idyllic life, I wouldn't change it, because it's all part of what it is I'm trying to do, which is to write.
You have gone back to Joyce, who's been a big hero for 60 years, and you've gone to theatre to express him and the women around him in this new play. But prose really has been at the centre of what you do. Is there another book? Is there another play?
No, I want to write another play.
And do we know about what?
I'm very taken, everyone is very taken with the Greeks, including James Joyce. And I did write a version of it that was done at the Crucible Theatre, where they do the snooker of Iphigenia. A thing that has always interested me, but this time I'll make it much more raw. Iphigenia, as a young child, is sacrificed, going to be burnt at the pyre, because the goddess Artemis is annoyed. The goddess Artemis is annoyed, and she stops the winds. She stops the fleet from going back to fight. So Iphigenia has to be sacrificed. But it's all on account of Helen of Troy, who went off very willingly from her husband Menelaus. And my question to myself, and what inflames me or excites me to write the play, is it's time for the women in this play now. Like, I have a little line in it. I haven't done much of it, and won't for at least 6 months, because there's another T.S. Eliot book half written. And at one point, the wife of Agamemnon, she says, let Helen be sacrificed. Why our daughter? And he says, the goddess wanted it. And she says, goddess, goddess, men wanted it.
We're back to the young woman at the centre of the story.
Yes,
again,
absolutely.
Aren't we?
Which is the theme. What I wanted, if I ever live long enough or keep my marbles enough to do it, I want, in a way, which is not the most cheerful thing to say to you, the women become identical to the men in their savagery. So that's, I think I've told you too much.
Well, let me ask one further question, because it strikes me. I'm quite surprised to the way you describe the upcoming, or the start of the new play. It has an inherent drama, even in your own description of it. I wonder if there's something about the collaborative nature of theatre which is now attractive to you in a post-COVID era when we were all so isolated. And for, I guess, for the most part, a novelist's job is in total isolation.
Yes, I wrote, we were all in rather, and my house went on fire, which didn't help the drama. I think what drama, especially, and I'm not just trying to be boastful because I don't wish to be, but what drama and this drama has allowed me a freedom. And if you like, an audaciousness that I didn't know I had. It has allowed me that. Now, when you see the play, you might think differently. But here I am declaring
your audacity.
My luggage, what's in my suitcase at the customs hall.
Edna,
it gave me freedom.
As always, it's an absolute joy to speak with you. Thanks for coming into us this evening.
Well, I'm so thankful.
If you'll be the last of Aucrum, as I am taking you to be, come tell me the last token passed between you and me. Oh, don't you remember that night beyond Lean Hill, where we both met together? I'm sorry now to tell. The rain falls on my heavy locks, and dew soaks my skin. My babe lies cold within my arms, and none will let me in. Oh, the rain falls on my heavy locks, and dew soaks my skin. My babe lies cold within my arms, and none will let me in.
And that was Lisa O'Neill with her recording of The Lass of Aucrum to conclude Irina's tribute to the great Irish novelist Edna O'Brien, who died yesterday.